Thanks for the introduction, Peter. Is this on? Is it on?
Check. Yeah,
okay. Name's Dan Niles. Team leader for the Sustainable Land Management Vision Team. We're addressing Goal 2. There's been a lot of changes in the teams. I took over about halfway through the process of getting together and assembling folks to direct our efforts towards looking at measurable Goal 2. And I like to restate it because it's good to keep focused on it. And that is, by 2025, 80% of lands within any watershed will be managed to maintain healthy watershed functions. And we want the remaining 20% to exhibit positive trends in key watershed parameters. It's a tall order, and there's a lot of effort going towards this. I'd like to acknowledge the team members. Lisa McCann is our sponsor. She's been invaluable helping guide the process. Team leader, and then the rest of the staff, and these staff, as Michael mentioned, cut across all programs and have multiple disciplines and backgrounds, so it brings together a nice collage of folks to work on the project that we're in, the goal to accomplish what we need to get done. What we initially did to address Goal 2 was to put together a project charter, and this is in much more detail in your staff report. I'm going to hit some of the highlights here. It was an outline of a plan to begin to tackle our task. In the charter, we define sustainable land management and the basic principles of sustainable land management are maintaining environmental functions, ecological processes, and biological diversity. There's more to it than that, but these are the kind of the broad overarching principles of sustainable land management that we're aiming to achieve. Urban and agricultural practices that affect water quality were identified specifically so that we can focus our efforts. We also identified short-term actions and long-term actions within the project chart, and I'll be talking about those now. Short-term actions towards sustainable land management. First, we wanted to conduct in-house interviews to find out, are there ways to optimize our existing programs and our approaches to things to better align with our vision? That was an important effort. We're going to come out with recommendations on how we can better optimize and streamline different processes to work towards that objective. We also are going to be identifying urban pesticide management programs with the municipal stormwater permit program. We're finding that there's a pretty good level of toxicity with, you know, from urban sources of pesticides. We're looking at hydro modification controls. Peter touched on that a little bit, and I'll go into it a little bit more. And that's to maintain the integrity and watershed functions. Low impact development standards, methods and tools. We're already working with local municipalities to see where we could implement this into the process, or these, you know, measures and standards in order to achieve, you know, better functioning watersheds. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on that as well. We're also looking at agricultural, irrigation, and nutrient management plans in order to reduce load of, say, nitrates and also pesticide runoff, and just improve watershed functions and come to a little bit more sustainability and to achieve our goal. We're also looking at, to see whether or not there are other water quality issues that we aren't currently addressing that might have a significant impact that we need to start to tackle. So it's a pretty broad spectrum. As Michael mentioned earlier, one of the things that's new and I think that we're improving upon, and this is a good feedback mechanism, is to look at our measures of success and how do we measure our effectiveness. And we have parameters to do that. We've identified two, and we want to look at tangible outcomes for improved sustainable land management, improved watershed functions. The two that we've initially identified are percent impervious surfaces and toxicity in urban and agricultural runoff. There's more, but these are the two that we had a lot of data on, and we figured let's get started on, you know, looking at some measures that we have some robust data sets on. And I'll go into those now. Percent impervious surfaces, why is it important? Well, watershed degradation increases directly with increasing impervious surfaces. Minimizing impervious surfaces protects watershed functions, reduces pollutants, controls stormwater runoff, and increases groundwater recharge. These are all components that are important for watershed function and also relate to measures of sustainable land management. Here's a graph you might be familiar with. It's relationship between impervious cover and stream water quality. On the left, you have watershed impervious cover. And on the bottom, you have level of stream quality. And these blocks here kind of represent thresholds. And this line in the middle going through represents the relationship between impervious cover and stream water quality. As you can see, as percent imperviousness increases, you hit these thresholds of diminishing level of stream water quality. So our goal is to mitigate that for new developments and also for existing urban areas, look for ways to maybe retrofit. So it's a two-pronged approach to tackle this issue. Here's an example of what we're using as a tool for measuring imperviousness. This is an image that was derived from satellite imagery that was rendered. And you can see here in the red here. This is satellite imagery showing impervious surfaces. And these divisions are called watershed planning units. They're roughly divided by watershed and then carved up a little more in order to kind of break off chunks to make the management of these different areas more feasible. The next image is directly derived from the previous, and this shows relative percent imperviousness within these watershed planning units. Karen's going to go into a lot more detail about how the data were derived and how we're going to be using this as a tool from this point on. But this is an example of how we're starting to kind of gather information and put it together in a format where we can actually use it to measure our relative effectiveness in our work efforts. Zooming in, this is a picture of Santa Barbara. You can see the city limits here. And this, again, is the rendered satellite imagery showing imperviousness. See the city boundary. The next one is going to show how we calculate off of that satellite imagery relative to percent imperviousness in different areas. You can see here the city boundary. These have some what we call catchments. Those are small-scale areas that we're going to kind of zoom in on to focus our efforts as far as looking at urban areas to reduce imperviousness, hopefully through retrofit, and also, like I mentioned, focus on undeveloped areas with looking to get low-impact development standards to maybe reduce the relative percent of imperviousness. Peter talked a lot about the hydrograph. What I'm going to explain here is a little different. You have a rate of flow over time. So you have rainfall events. So under conventional construction, what we get are these, you know, quick, spiky, flashy runoff, rainfall or runoff. What we're aiming to do and what our measure is to look at pre- and post-development. You have pre-development hydrographic curve. It's kind of smooth, you know, depending on where you're at in the watershed. And what we want to do, our measure, our metrics of success, if you will, is to measure the post-development hydrograph and see if we could match it to make sure that we maintain watershed functions, because this is a pretty key issue. And Peter mentioned that we sent out a letter recently looking at standards for hydro modification controls with municipalities. The next parameter that we're looking at is toxicity and runoff. This is a pretty robust indicator, and it includes a lot of things. Reduced toxicity is an indicator of sustainable land management practices and improved watershed functions. One of the tools, I'm sure you're all familiar with this, is the Central Coast Ambient Monitoring Program. Karen will go into a lot more detail about the data, but why I'm showing you this is it represents broad-spectrum data on toxicity and lethal effects using four species. And, you know, in a nutshell, it'd be nice to take the red areas here, which shows, you know, lethal and toxic effects, and turn them yellow and green. That would be a measure of, you know, that what we're doing on the land and how it affects water is improving, I mean, in the very basic sense. And I think this is an important kind of broad measure of that. And so those are the two parameters, impervious surface and toxicity and runoff, that we're looking at as our early indicators of our, you know, what we're doing and how it's affecting water quality. Long-term actions, as I mentioned, that we're looking to protect groundwater recharge areas. We're coordinating across the organization and with the clean groundwater team. We want to develop protections for recharge areas. We want the water to recharge. As population grows, we're going to need that water at some point. Establish riparian buffer zones. Right now, it's voluntary. We want to get a robust protection in place into our basin plan, hopefully through basin plan amendment. to have a structure in order to require riparian buffer zones, because we know that those are important for sustainable land management and healthy aquatic habitat and groundwater recharge. We want to refine water quality and land use relationships. There's a lot of different things that affect water quality as far as activities on the land, and what we're doing is we're always constantly refining our measures of what we're looking at as far as water quality, not only surface water but also groundwater, and those relationships on the land as far as what's going on. We also want to engage stakeholders on low impact development in reaching out to municipalities. I know Roger and Michael have been working on that quite a bit already with Low Impact Development Institute, and we want to get standards in place with the city and counties in order to look at low impact development methods, techniques, in order to help sustainable land management and also watershed functions. And that all these are going towards our measurable goal too. We want to address growth in water supply. As I mentioned, our population growth is quite large, and water quantity is inextricably related to water quality. So, you know, we're going to have to look at that within our basins. We also need to respond to global water quality trends, and there's three really good examples. 30% of the particulate off the west coast of North America comes from China burning coal in their coal-fired plants, and a lot of mercury is coming over with that. That's something that's kind of out of our hands, but we're going to have to deal with it. Another example is pharmaceuticals in our water supply, surface water and groundwater. Another example is increase in acidity of the oceans through increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So those are just things that we're going to have to put into our tool chest as far as how, and, you know, what we're looking at, how we're going to respond to it. So in conclusion, we're applying multiple tools and actions towards measurable goal 2, sustainable land management, healthy watershed functions. We're measuring our success, and we're finding out new measures, and we're going to be implementing new measures and also refining the ones that we already have. And we're coordinating internally and externally to align towards our vision overall. And with that, I'd like to introduce Matt Keeling.
Question for you, Dan.
Yeah.
Can you back up to the slide that has the watershed subunits on it? Kind of a mosaic.
The next one?
Actually, let's look at the one before that. Okay.
That's the first one.
Well, you know, that one and then the one that followed it that we just looked at. What would staff's response be to a discharger who was not in a yellow or red zone that said, why should we implement LID? You know, we're not in an area where, you know, imperviousness
identified as a high risk.
Right. How do you?
I think, you know, overall our approach is to not let things get worse. I mean, just because they have a clean baseline, that doesn't mean we can degrade up to a certain percentage. What we'd like to do, obviously, is that we're, you know, there's no way of restricting development. We certainly craft how that development might look in the future and how it might affect our watersheds and water quality. Certainly, you know, under the Water Code, we have a very broad mandate to do that. And I think that, you know, through our outreach programs and other things that, you know, we could fill in, like, let's just, for instance, our high growth areas, Salinas, Monterey, and Santa Maria, you know, maybe with all new developments, if we implement low impact development or their ordinances in place to drive that, that what we'll be getting into is what's called, I didn't do this specifically, but more details, what's called effective imperviousness, meaning that you can build over it, but if we didn't change the hydrograph and the stream functions are still working, then the effective imperviousness is effectively zero if you've maintained baseline conditions, even though you've developed in an area. So I think that kind of gets at your question. You know, let's maintain what we have and then also improve maybe, you know, areas that are already impacted.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure you guys had thought about that, because I could see someone taking that information and turning it around.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely an issue.
And then you showed us Santa Barbara just as an example of a particular area. Do we have that level of information for all of those sub-watershed units?
We're working on it. Okay. Brandon Sanderson put this together for this presentation, and he's been working on what we consider micro-scale catchments, and that's what these represent. Is each one of these reaches represents a catchment, and then when it combines, there's different terminology for the different reaches that come down. And Depending on the relative level of intensity, that would focus our efforts. Obviously, in the highly urbanized portion where we have a lot of imperviousness, you know, we might want to look at retrofit options for improving water quality, maybe unchannelizing streams, as Peter showed. There's a great project down in Los Angeles, Malibu Creek, where they took out the stretch of concrete, and it's amazing what grew in, and stream channels allowed to braid a little bit. It didn't affect surrounding property. You know, through flooding, they were able to maintain flood controls and other stuff like that. So I think this would focus opportunities on the highest risk areas where we need restoration, but on a much smaller scale. And we're doing this for our entire region. To mm-hmm. answer your question specifically, we want to get to this level of resolution. That's what we are working on.
Right. And then how does this information, like, get into Matt's hands, who might be working on stormwater permits for the county or the city of Santa Barbara, and he's looking at their permit and dealing with LID?
Yeah, well, you know, Brandon Sanderson, who put this together, is a part of the stormwater group. Okay. So, and we have a very deliberate process where we conduct water quality assessments where we look at all the site-specific conditions, like the TMDLs that might be in that area, the relative impervious of a particular area, the particular pollutants of concern. So we make sure the stormwater management program is designed to address those site-specific issues.
So. And also, one of the goals of the assessment team is to put together an information management structure that is available to staff to get access to all the products that come out of this process. So it's not just, you know, the vision teams that have access to this information, but we package it in a way that makes it accessible probably to both staff and the public.
And are they accessing it, most staff?
This is pretty preliminary right now.
Okay.
Yeah, we're working on that.
Okay.
That's part of our, you know, this year's activity is
right.
What we're working on.
And Matt, is this kind of information being used to alert, you know, the county or the city of Santa Barbara that, hey, you've got over 25% pervious substrate? At this point, maybe that's what you're working.
Well, I think the particular stormwater entities program managers are aware of their relative imperviousness, but we have not yet gone to, say, Monterey and Lompoc and the areas that you saw in red and some of the previous figures and say and warn them that we're going to focus on them yet. We haven't done that yet.
Is that something you're going to do in time, or is that... I see this as very important data to justify doing lots of things to improve water quality. You can't really dispute that.
Yeah. And, you know, it has helped us to focus our LID outreach.
Right.
You know, I'm of the opinion that it's most cost effective to try and control future growth. In you know, the areas that we know are growing fast, like San Benito County, Salinas, Paso Robles, Santa Maria. And so we are using that information, along with a lot of other information about new development that is coming, to focus the LID outreach that we have started.
I just wanted to add for clarification that I think this information was just developed last week or 2 weeks ago, as far as actually being able to display it and start to evaluate it. So to specifically... address your question. We fully intend to share the information, but since we don't have it together, and we're building it.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure you realize that.
I think you're developing great information.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's dynamite. I just like to, you know, make sure that you're going to use it fully. You know, of course, the sooner the better, like with everything. And I think this paints a very compelling picture as to why. You know, structural changes should be done, because I don't know how you really refute that.
That's one of the things that we're working on crafting.
Good.
You know, this is like a preliminary tool, and
sure.
We're going to kind of see what spawns off of that through outreach and other
things. Right. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Your original question emphasizes what we've been discussing about the importance of scale. If you go back to the original one of the region, if you look at this in total, and if we were talking about this, well, what are we going to use most most as the pertinent scale. And if you were to look at imperviousness on a region-wide basis, you could say, hey, we're good, you know, and there could be a whole lot of development. We're still good. And if you go to the next one, you can see that, for example, the Salinas, this is called a planning watershed, it doesn't show up as red or orange, and yet we know that if you look at the area of Salinas, it would be comparable to Santa Barbara, which turns up red. So that's a reflection of the scale that we're looking at, and these perhaps somewhat arbitrary planning watersheds, that's the way it turns out. You could say the same thing about King City, Soledad, which has been subject to a lot of growth increase recently. And so it demonstrates the importance of scale. And really what makes sense, I think, is to look at what's important for the watershed and match up the scale with what's important for the watershed. So likewise, you can see Santa Barbara shows up as orange here. It says that's 11 to 15% imperviousness. And then the next slide, when you zoom in, you look at a different scale. The next one. Next one, Dan.
That's based on the city boundary.
Then here you can see that you've got a significant area that's greater than 25%. So, right. And that's something we were discussing the other day, was the importance of scale. And chances are we're going to be using different scales depending on what we want to show and what's important for the watershed. But your point is well taken, that we have to make sure that we're clear about that, because to someone that we're dealing with outside the office, they could look at some of these maps and say, we're good. What are you giving us a hard time for? So that is very important.
Yeah. Also, Jeff, you mentioned making this information available to municipalities so they know what's going on. And we're increasing our ability to do that, increasing our capacity to do that all the time through CCAMP and our website. And as Matt mentioned, many municipalities are aware of this issue. But one of the things we did is sent out a letter to our Phase 2 municipalities, those less than 100,000 people, those that have not received permit coverage yet, so there's quite a few of those. And we sent out a letter that said, here's what we expect to see in your stormwater management plans that are coming up, that you're working on now.
This is the February letter.
Yeah. And that letter, by saying we expect to see hydro modification controls and impervious surface or effective impervious surface limitations on every development site, makes those municipalities consider these issues. They have to consider this in order to meet those expectations, in order to develop, either use the standards or the performance measures that we have in that letter, or to develop their own. They have to consider this type of information. So there are different ways of raising the level of awareness of this type of information, and we're doing it in a bunch of different ways: education and outreach and requirements and several different ways.
This is just the picture that's worth a thousand words. And I think if you would be interesting to overlay the 303 delisted bodies with graphs like that, not graphs, but maps like that, because I think, doesn't Santa Barbara have a couple in through that red zone? Possibly, yeah. Mission Creek or Arroyo Burro Creek.
Both.
Both, yeah, you know. That says a lot.
That's it. Matt,
okay.
Healing.
Thank you.
Queen Groundwork. You're welcome.